Hey, everybody, it's Mark Patterson back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And before I get into today's amazing guest, I want to remind everybody to go to my website, markpattersonnfl.com. And there you can find other amazing podcasts of incredible people doing amazing stuff. And if you would, please go in and give it a ratings and review. It always helps with the popularity of the show. Not that I need to be popular, but people need to hear these inspiring stories. Also, the film, NFL, is filmed on me going up and down Everest. It's going to be epic. That's coming out early September. More on that. That will be posted on the website. And finally, regarding the philanthropy I've been associated with, Higher Ground, Amelia's Everest. We continue to raise money for that great cause, and it's always great to give back. Okay, on that note, let's get into it. Today's guest, I'm very honored to have Mike Ruzziani, the Olympic gold medalist hero so many years ago. But first of all, we'll introduce Mike. How you doing?
Good, Mark. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing great. Look at, you know, you, I work for Sports Illustrated now, and in my research, I saw that SI, Sports Illustrated, had named your winning goal as one of the greatest sports moments of the 20th century. What a great honor. I mean, think about all the amazing stuff that the Americans have done in various sports, and to have that stand out as that single greatest moment of the 20th century. I mean, how do you wrap your mind around that?
Yeah, it's hard to do that. But, you know, I think, you know, I've realized that over 41 years that this moment was more than a hockey game for a lot of people. And I think that's what the Olympic Games are in general anyway. It's not like a Super Bowl team. One city wins, one city loses, and a bunch of other cities don't care. But when it's the Olympic Games, it's a nation that feels a part of it. And I think that's what made our moment so special for so many people. It meant more than just, you know, us winning a gold medal. So I think when you look at it that way, I think you take great pride in knowing that, you know, we touch so many lives.
Well, I got to tell you about my life, because there's not too many things that I remember. I'm sure I have a full CTE, you know, with my concussion playing in the NFL. But there's one moment in time, and when I say this, it's vivid like it was yesterday. And I'm a senior in high school, and I drove my car. I had a Dodge Aspen, and I'd driven up to a little ski resort about 1 hour outside of Seattle, Washington, my hometown. And in my hometown, there's a little mountain up there called Alpental. And so I'd driven up, and I was listening to this event, and Al Michaels making the call. And I it was a sunny bluebird day, and I kept wanting to get out of the car, and I couldn't, because I was so gripped to the radio, right, and listening to this play out and this impossible story. And I think one thing that a lot of times, you know, people forget about, because they associate so much, you know, your winning goal and the Americans beating the Russians, and you guys were a collection of these really high school plus kids playing against these essentially NHL professionals, you know, in the Russian league. And that's why it became such an amazing upset. But that wasn't the gold, the finals, right? I believe that was the semifinals.
Yes, yes. People still think we only played one game. You know, everybody talks about the Soviet game, but if we don't beat Finland, we're not having this conversation. You know, I could see people coming up to me 40 years later and saying, boy, that was a great Olympics, but damn, if you only could have beat Finland to win the gold medal. So as great as the Soviet victory was, if we don't close the deal, this story is not the story that it's become.
So often in football, they talk about your last game, your last play. And I've had it go for me in a very positive way. My last play at the University of Washington was in the Orange Bowl. I caught the winning touchdown with a few minutes left to go in the game to beat Oklahoma. And, you know, it was a sideline toe tapping, you know, it was amazing. And, you know, I happened to come down with it. I've also known other players that missed the field goal, or, you know, that was their last moment that people remember that. And for you to be associated with something like that, like you said, was just such a great, I was talking to my buddy last night who came into town. And I said, you know, one of the magical things about the way that played out is, you know, certainly it was an incredible, like, odd beating game in moment, like you said, in history. And it went way beyond just the sport of hockey, right? It was about our country versus their country. And Al Michaels was the guy that was calling the game, or the game, right? Or the is it what you call it? Is it a game? Is it what? Yeah, is it a contest?
That's a game. Yeah.
Okay. So he's calling the game, and it's the semifinals. And, you know, I was sitting in the Alpental parking lot listening to this, waiting to go up and go skiing, but I couldn't because you guys, you know, like, there's no way you're going to win this and actually pull this thing off. And to have those words, do you believe in miracles, right? And then I was asking my buddy, what was he going through? And he goes, I remember the exact same moment. He was in Seattle, and he was driving his car down this road, and he just kept saying, holy F, holy F, holy F, right? And I'm in my car just going, whoa. I mean, I just, you know, but where I'm trying to go with this is that for Al Michaels to have something that is was so non-scripted and understand the moment in history of what that meant, and for those magical words to come out, do you believe in miracles? I mean, you've been living this for a long time, right?
Yeah, it's funny. When I play golf with Al a few times a year, and we played out in Tahoe a couple of years ago, and almost every fairway we were walking down, somebody would yell out, hey, Al, hey, Mike, do you believe in miracles? And Al and I look at each other and go, here we go again. So Al deals with it probably a lot more than I did, but he made an incredible call. And then when we beat Finland, this impossible dream comes true. Again, another, you know, perfect example of what was taking place.
What was the magic formula of that team? You were the captain. I want to make sure that's clear. I've been around you. You're a dynamic guy and everything. But, you know, you got to have, you know, the weakest link of the chain has to be rowing in the same direction with everybody. Right. What was it about that team that made it so powerful?
There were a few things. One, we were a lot better than people thought. I mean, I think we were better than we thought. You know, some of these players, teammates of mine, went on and had great NHL careers, and they were 18, 19, 20 years old at the time. And American hockey players weren't given a lot of credit to be considered professionals because it was usually just the Canadian game. And I don't think the Americans got the chances they should have gotten, especially the college players. You know, if you didn't play major junior, then you weren't considered a player. So I think clearly we were good, but we had the ability to work together. You know, Mark Johnson was our best hockey player. We don't win without Mark Johnson. Every time we needed a big play, Mark made it. But his wings had to do their job. The defenseman had to do their job. The goaltender had to do his job. And we played four lines. We didn't just play one, two, three lines. We rolled four lines consistently throughout the Olympic Games. So, you know, the phrase I like to use is we were a group of players who not only believed in themselves but believed in each other. And there was a bond and a love and a respect and a commitment that we had as a team. Even 40 years later, the love and bond that we have is incredible. So it was, you know, the perfect storm, the right team, the right time, the right coach. You know, everything came together. But when you look back on things, clearly we were good. And clearly we had an incredible believing in ourselves and each other. And the work ethic, the 6 months of training, you know, we wore teams down in the Olympic Games. And I just heard this stat a little while ago. In the third period of the Olympic Games, we outscored our opponents 16-3. I mean, that's an incredible number. Yeah. And that just shows the conditioning and the type of team that we had when we were trailing in every single game but one. And you know, you're an athlete. The true test of a team is how they respond when the backs are to the wall. Yeah. You know, when you're winning, everybody's high-fiving and laughing and joking, and we are leading. But when you're faced like the Finland game, 20 minutes of hockey, we're down a goal. If we lose that game or tie, we might not win a medal. But yet we played our best hockey. Of the whole Olympic Games, I thought the best hockey we played was the last 20 minutes of Finland, where we dominated the game, scored 3 goals, won 4-2. I think those are the things that I remember the most about why our team was successful.
John Wooden has a saying about be at your best when your best is required. And I think that certainly applied to that particular moment in time with you guys. As we talk, we're July 28th today. This will run in a month or so. And we're knee deep in the Olympics, and there is a situation brewing in the women's Olympic with Simone Biles in terms of her pulling out today. And she cited that as in terms of mental health, right? And I think it's just all the pressure that everybody put all their chips, all the sponsors on her, you know, cleaning up, calling her the goat, all this kind of stuff. And she seems like she kind of blew a fuse in terms of just like, I can't handle this and I'm out. right? From your standpoint, when you were there, because you guys were such underdogs and you weren't viewed as the GOAT, and I mean, I'm talking about team versus individual, although they do a team gymnastics thing. But, you know, did you feel any kind of pressure in that kind of way?
No, not even close. And I feel so. I just did an interview regarding Simone, and you know what incredible courage it took for her to make that decision. You know, mental health is a big problem in this country, especially in, you know, not everywhere, not only in sports, but you know, I just saw a special. I was on a plane recently. Michael Phelps did a special on mental health and some of the battles that he's had with it. It's an unbelievable show. I highly recommend anybody that feels they have those kind of issues to watch this special. But you think of the pressure on her. You know, as a hockey player, you got 19 other teammates. You know, you can distribute that pressure. Mm-hmm. We didn't feel pressure because we weren't expected to win. Maybe we had pressure going into the Finland game, but I tell people, we were so young, we didn't even know what pressure was. We just wanted to play. We were having fun. But I think for someone like Simone, you think of, you know, like you said, the sponsor, the world watching. She's the greatest Olympic gymnast we've ever seen. And what she did on her routines was, I mean, you can't even describe it. So I can't imagine the pressure that she had, knowing clearly it seems like she's got some kind of an injury bothering her. Mm-hmm. And for her to think that she can't perform at her best, and maybe that was part of it as well. She, you know, the world was watching. The United States clearly watching, waiting for her to perform. You know, her and Katie Ledecky were going to be the kind of the two big names of the games. And yeah. You know, wait till you see Simone Biles. Watch what she's going to do. So, you know, I feel bad. I feel bad for her and what she's dealing with. I hope that she can come back and compete. She, you know, she hasn't ruled out the rest of the Olympics yet. Obviously, when this airs, we'll know her decision. But yeah. The pressure on her and the courage for her to make that decision to say, I just can't do it.
Did you feel, and we're talking about pressure for her as an individual, and you just said that you didn't feel any pressure because you really redistributed amongst all the other teammates that you had on that team. But as captain, did you feel any kind of responsibility in terms of you were really the extension of the coach? And the coach must have been just this amazing, motivating force. But again, you know, he needs, yeah, I mean, essentially, if you look back on the great Laker teams, you got Magic Johnson, or the Boston Celtic teams, Larry Bird. I mean, you got to have that one player that like sets the standard for everybody else to follow.
Well, I think our, you know, and not to take anything away from what I did, but we had a team of leaders. Mm. There were 20 guys in the hockey team. Every one of them was captain of their high school team or college teams. So when you're in a room of 20 players, I've always said I was a captain amongst captains. Like I said earlier, Mark Johnson was our best player. Not only was our best player, he was a great teammate. And your best players have to be great teammates as well. And we had 20 great teammates. So it's easy to be, you know, a captain of like I said, of captains when each one of those guys have carried that mantle, you know, have been in that position before, whether it's their college team or their high school teams. And again, I think that's another quality of our success, was to have those type of players in that room. And Herb was an unbelievable coach. He was a great motivator. He was old school. Herb didn't care if you liked him. And there was a lot of times we didn't like him, mm-hmm. but it was important you respected him. And there was never once a time we didn't respect him. We trusted him. And he was brilliant putting this team together and the formula to our success.
What do you think that then, if you are amongst, you know, you were a captain amongst captains, what do you think that point of difference was then that puts you as the leader of that team? I mean, I hear what you said, but at some point in time, your head coach has to look back and say, okay, you know, you're the guy.
I think maybe the respect that my teammates had for me off the ice, mm-hmm. As well as on the ice. I'm a pretty easygoing guy. I think when I was elected captain, players didn't think, oh my God, here's Mike. I'm going to be the captain. I'm no different today than I was in high school. And I think maybe my teammates saw that I was a person that they trusted, that they liked, that they got along with, and that I wasn't going to be this, you know, you better do what I say kind of a guy. I was, you lead by example. And my example is to just be myself. You can't become somebody different.
So certainly we're all a product of our environment. And I grew up in the West Coast. I grew up in Seattle. And so I was going out and playing typically the traditional, you know, football and basketball and baseball, it was always raining on us, it seemed like, you know, but hockey wasn't a big deal, you know, certainly on the West Coast. And when you look at where you grew up in Boston, Mass, and all that kind of stuff, you know, it seems like you were on this path since you were a little kid and you excelled in this particular sport.
Yeah, I was a football, hockey, baseball player. I played actually more baseball in my life than hockey. And in high school, football was my passion. I was actually an all-state football, hockey, and baseball player. I didn't decide to be a hockey player till I got out of high school, really, when the opportunity to play at Boston University came out for me. But, you know, my intention was to play football, hockey, and baseball in college, and obviously found out you couldn't play all three, so I ended up playing two, and then had to stop playing baseball because I ended up making the world championship team and had to leave school the last month to go play in Europe. But I was an athlete, you know. I mean, sports was my life. You know, I was in that era where you could leave the house and come back when the streetlights came on, you know, and my mother didn't have to drive me to practice or wait in the stands and watch me practice. She'd, you know, I'd walk to the hockey rink. I'd walk to the baseball field. I'd walk to the football field. So it was a very different era. It's not easy being a kid today. I liked it when I was growing up. It was a lot safer, and you had no social media. You didn't have all the distractions. You could be a kid.
Yeah.
And as a kid, that's what I did. I played sports. I tell kids now, I wish I studied a little more, because I was that guy that was always looking to play a game. And I think that was part of maybe the reason I was somewhat a success or a good athlete, because I played everything.
Yeah, and there's no question you and I are birds of the same feather. That's exactly what I did. It's just like I was a full-on gym rat, you know, as they call it. You know, you've been very fortunate to have a broadcasting career in terms of calling five Olympics. As a Olympian and calling Olympic, I mean, what's it like to be, you know, nominated, elected, chosen, whatever the word is, you know, to the team, and then actually go through that process? And you've seen it as a player, and you've seen it as a, we'll call it a spectator, but as a broadcaster.
It's the fact of what an honor it is. To put the jersey on that says USA across the front. To do it as an athlete was special. To stand on the podium like I did in Lake Placid, to hear 19,000 people singing the Star Spangled Banner, see your flag being risen just a little higher than others, is an incredible, incredible feeling. And to do it as a broadcaster, to get to know the athletes and what they're going through and what they've dealt with to get there, the pride that they have. So I was able to see it as an athlete, feel it as an athlete, but then watch other athletes feel the same way. And it is a special moment. Like I said, it's not a Super Bowl. It's not a World Series. It's the Olympics. And you know, there's a lot of professional athletes out there, but there aren't many Olympians. So I think we take a great pride in that. And again, that having been a commentator, seeing these athletes perform, seeing some not perform as well as they would have liked, still mm-hmm. the honor that they have of being there. You know, not every Olympian goes to the Olympic Games thinking they're going to win a gold medal, because some have no chance, but they want to perform at their best level. They want maybe coming in fifth place instead of 12th place. You know, maybe that bronze medal that you won was something that nobody thought you could even get to. So it's not to me always about gold, bronze, and silver. Clearly we want gold. That's what you strive for. But you know, reality sets in at some point as well, knowing that there might be some other athletes in the world that are a little better than you, but you're one of the best that the United States can send. That's a great, you know, tribute.
Yeah, if you take out Lake Placid, you know, the one that you were involved in, what is your favorite Olympics that you participated in as a broadcaster?
I think when I watched Dan Jansen win the gold medal, you know, here's a kid that fell in his first race, and then his next race fell again. And what does he do? He trains again 4 more years to come back for that one race, and he doesn't skate well. But the race that he's not supposed to win the gold medal, he wins the gold medal. I think it was Lillehammer, I believe. And it was just amazing watching that performance. I was in Vancouver as an ambassador with then Vice President Biden. So the Vancouver games were pretty amazing as well, because it was so beautiful.
Yeah.
But they were all special. I mean, Calgary was spectacular. Mirabel was, Sarajevo. Sarajevo was just so sad to see what happened to that country. Mm-hmm. When I was there, it was so beautiful, so kind of old. I remember one day Eric Heiden and I were going out for a run. And as we're running down the streets, there's a woman coming towards us with a big ox and a and all her goods in the wagon behind the ox. And she was maybe about, looked like about 5 feet tall. And she had all these kind of coverings over her. And I'm thinking that was so beautiful with big snowflakes. And you got to appreciate some of the countries that hosted these games. So I think the Dan Jansen moment and then just seeing the people in Sarajevo was pretty incredible.
I think Dan Jansen, you're referring to the speed skater, correct?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Eric Heiden as well. You had a book, I just want to mention this really quick, the book, The Making of a Miracle, The Untold Story by the Captain of the Gold Medal Winning Team. That's you. So what is in this book and tell me more about it?
Well, I wrote the book for one reason and one reason only. I even told the people at HarperCollins who published it, I don't care if anybody buys the book. They said, well, you're not supposed to say that.
Yeah.
I went, well, I wrote the book for one reason only. I have now 6 grandkids. And hope to have a couple more. And I want my grandkids to know that Papa's life wasn't one game, one day, one goal, one moment. I wanted my grandkids to know about their great-grandfather, their great-grandmother. I wanted my grandkids to know about my life, how I grew up, the love and support I had of a family. You'll find my growing up is pretty interesting. And I actually live 2 houses from the house I grew up in. And my son just bought the house directly behind me. He put the gate in yesterday. He can walk from his yard right through to my yard. And my daughter lives down the street with three of my grandsons. So I grew up in a very loving, caring, family-oriented, home. We didn't have a lot of money. We had very little money. But my mother always found a way to put food on the table. My dad worked 3 jobs. And I think growing up in that family, I grew up in a 3-family house. My mother's brother lived upstairs. My mother's brother married my father's sister. So they lived on the 3rd floor. My father's other sister lived on the 1st floor. There were 15 kids in the house when my mother was pregnant. My aunts were pregnant. So I have cousins the same age. I have kids the same age as my cousin's kids. In my hometown, 1 year of the high school baseball team, the starting 9, 6 of them were relatives. And we had 7 years in a row, the outstanding student athlete at our high school was somebody who came out of the 3 family that I grew up in. So I think you'll find in the book, stories about my life that people don't know about that I don't care if anybody reads them, but I want my grandkids and someday their kids to know who I was and what my family was all about.
That's so awesome. Just being a strong family guy and just really understanding the power of unity and coming together. And I can only imagine, I say this in a very loving way, but just complete family chaos, and that household of running around and people, trying to get along and, all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, it made you stronger, right?
Yeah, my dad was born on the 4th of July. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago, but we have a traditionally 4th of July party. And we get anywhere from 80 to 100 people in the backyard, and probably 70 of them are relatives. And this Friday coming up, we have our family outing. My uncle always called us the greatest family. So we have the greatest family cup golf tournament coming up Friday, and there's going to be 32 of us competing against each other. And then the winning team will win the cup. And then we all come back to my house after for barbecue and drinks, and all their wives and their kids come. So it's a great place. It's a great way to grow up.
That is awesome. What do you think the state of hockey is today?
Oh, it's spectacular. The skill level of these players, it's off the charts, and probably all sports. But I think that the sport of hockey's grown more than anything. The influx of the Europeans, the performance of our goaltenders. Now, goaltenders of any sport, any position, the goaltending in hockey has changed dramatically, more than a quarterback, more than a running back, more than a center, a guard, anything like that. So that's what makes the game so incredible. And the size of the players.
Yeah.
When I played, you were 5'11", 6 feet. Now you're 6'4", 6'5". Mario Lemieux, 6'6", one of the greatest players ever to play the game. The players and where they're coming from, the guys from Texas, guys from Arizona, guys from California, guys from Florida. You never saw players in the NHL from those states. So the sport has grown. You're going to have a team in Seattle, which should have happened years ago. I think Seattle's going to love and the city's going to be great. Yes. And the game, the women's game, you see how many young ladies are playing the sport of hockey now and how good our women's programs are. Someone asked me the other day if the 80 Olympic team could compete against today's Olympic team. And I said, no chance. I said, I'm 67 years old.
Awesome.
The players are better. They're bigger, they're faster, they're stronger. And hockey's in a great state right now. It just continues to grow. And like I said, our women programs around the country is off the charts.
Well, that was one of the things when you and I, we were very fortunate to play in the Steve Azar golf tournament down in Greenville, Mississippi. And that's where you and I met, and we had, good time chatting and everything. And what surprised me about you, you were a tremendous player, but you're not gigantic in terms of the stature, the type of, player. Like I'm 6'3", and, maybe you could say I could still fit in today's game at the NFL level because they're, the wide receivers are anywhere from 6'2 to 6'4". But they're, they're like 225 running these insane times now, right? I mean, it's just like, it's crazy. And like you said, the hockey player in general, it just seems like the stature of their physical presence.
Right.
They're just a bigger, faster version of what you guys were.
Yeah. I work at Boston University, and we have an awfully good hockey program, and I get to know all of our players. As a matter of fact, I think Boston University has the most players in the National Hockey League right now who went to BU. But I see these players come in, and every year they're bigger, but their training is different. You know, I'll be honest, after practice, we went to the local bar down campus. You know, drinking age was 18 years old. You know, after practice, we'd get out and have a couple of beers, and pizza or whatever. These guys, when they've done practice, they go to the weight room. They work out constantly. It's a whole different mindset. We have a strength coach. We never had a strength coach when I was in school. We never lifted weights. You just played. So I think the training that they go through, because the future is so bright, the money is so good for them. You know, when I went to Boston University, you went because you wanted to play college hockey. Now the guys go to Boston University because they want to play in the National Hockey League. So it's a totally different mindset. So clearly the training that they go through, the foods that they're eating, way different than, what I would eat and drink. Totally different mindset.
Let me ask you this about Wayne Gretzky, because he's another guy I've, back in the day when they're playing in the Forum, and I used to go to the games, and at the time, the owner, who I was later thrown in jail, Bruce Brignell, would invite a bunch of us players over, and we'd sit in a special section and go down in the Forum Club afterwards and do all this stuff. But, you talk about a guy who's a pretty slight person, right. He, again, considering what he accomplished, he's called the great one. Do you think he could play in today's game? Way that he skated and everything?
Yeah, I think he would, but he wouldn't put up the numbers, which nobody does anymore anyway, because again, the goaltenders are so good and the players are a lot better. And the depth of teams right now is the fourth lines today are better than fourth lines 25, 30 years ago. Because there's so many players out there. And like I said earlier, the influx of the Europeans. Europeans weren't playing in that league then. The Russians, the Swedes, the Czechs, the Finns, the Germans. So many great players that are playing in the National Hockey League weren't either allowed or playing then. Gretzky would still be a great player. But he clearly, he wouldn't put up the numbers, 190 points, 180 points a year. That those days are long gone. If somebody gets 100, that's considered pretty good right now. But the great players would still be great players. But I think some of the goals he was scoring then, he probably wouldn't score today. And not because he's not great, but the goaltenders are so much better.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that answer. So what does life look like for you, from like today going forward?
Just keep enjoying it. I sometimes sit in my backyard, when I look out my backyard, I look to the left and that's the house that I grew up in. And I sit there and I got a glass of wine in front of me or I'm smoking a cigar and I'm thinking, boy, I'm glad we won. life is good. I still work at Boston University. I still do a lot of motivational speaking, traveling. The grandkids are a lot of fun. You kind of just keep, taking each day as it comes and enjoy it. Not every day is a great day too. Some days, maybe I don't putt as well. Maybe hit a couple of balls out of bounds, but I just enjoy life. My wife gets frustrated because I'm always happy and I always get a smile on my face, even through COVID. I try to be myself. I stay close to my friends, close to my family. I'm no different today than I was when I was a senior in high school, other than I'm 67 with kids and grandkids.
Well, do you believe in miracles? And in your case, certainly it's all come true. You're part of that golden moment in time. And it's really had a profound effect on your life in terms of your whole trajectory, in terms of playing in that game, broadcasting the Olympics, out there talking to various audiences, motivational speaking, writing a book, being involved in all these different golf tournaments. I mean, what a great life.
Like I said, we could have lost.
Well, then we probably wouldn't be talking. So this show should be the pinnacle of your Olympic career, right?
I've come full circle, Mark.
That's it. All right, buddy. Listen, thank you so much for coming on. I hope to
thank see you.
Azar golf tournament next year in Greenville, Mississippi. And you've just been amazing and motivational. And again, it's just that moment in time will always stand out for me.
Thank you, my friend. I look forward to seeing you at Steve's event. I'm actually going to see Steve at the end of the month. I'll tell him we talked.
Right on. All right. There he is. The one, the only, Mike Ruzioni. Thank you.
All right, bud. Take care.
Right on.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.